right, let's do this. How are you? What the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fucksters? What's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast, WTF. This is it. This is it. This is holiday week. Jimmy Tingle is on the show today. Jimmy Tingle is a comedian who I've known forever from Boston. He's got a thing coming up. He's got a big show coming up at the Wilbur Theater in Boston this Saturday, December 28th. He came out to talk to me and do a couple other things, but it's always nice to get into the groove with a Boston guy, to get into that rhythm. Mac, how are you? Nice to see you, Mac. Hey, Mac, what's happening? How are you, Mac? Everything all right, Mac? But Jimmy's here, so that'll be happening shortly. Today is the second day of Hanukkah, I believe. And I don't know. I don't get caught up in the whole happy holidays, Merry Christmas, happy Hanukkah, happy Kwanzaa, happy. Maybe I'm just not as sensitive, because generally, I mean, the appropriate thing to do, it's a matter of habit, I guess. When somebody says Merry Christmas, I say, I'm a Jew. I'm a Jew. And that's awkward for them. But, I think that's the proper response. Merry Christmas to you. I am a Jew. Why do you say that to me? I think it's fine to react that way. Happy holidays. I'm like, but can you be more specific? Well, Merry Christmas. I'm a Jew. God damn it. So that, I think that's the proper response to Merry Christmas. Even if you're not a Jew, it's fun to get that angry when someone's trying to be nice. Look, it is the second day of Hanukkah, and for those of you who don't know what Hanukkah is, I'm not sure I'm clear either, but I'm pretty sure it's when the Jews killed Jesus and burned him over 8 different nights, piece by piece. I believe that's it. And there's 9 candles, I think, and the 9th candle it represents Jesus, his arm, which we cut off first, the Jews that did it, and somehow managed. The miracle of it is that they were able to light the finger of that arm, and it burned for 8 days. They were able to light the other pieces of Jesus, and they lined all these pieces up like a menorah. That's where the menorah shape comes from. When they cut up Jesus, they stuck him in 8 different places, and they slowly set fire over 8 days of Hanukkah. I'm pretty sure that's the story. I might be conflating that with a anti-Semitic conspiracy theory. I'm not positive, but maybe I should Google that. Maybe I'm way off, because maybe I'm confusing it with Christmas. Isn't Christmas when Santa? The original Christmas is when Santa killed Jesus and then gave his parts away over. No. Oh, it's a birthday. I'm sorry. It's a Jesus' birthday. Wow. Merry Christmas. I'm a Jew. God damn it. I hope you are having a happy Hanukkah, and I hope your Christmas is pleasant as well, because I will not talk to you. That was a heavy way to start. I'll agree with that. The dark satire, maybe just crass, morbid religious jokes. Not for everybody, perhaps not funny. I want you to have a good Christmas and try to treat each other nice. There's always the possibility this could be it. I mean, Christmas could be filled with nuclear chaos. Korean nuclear chaos. We don't know. Maybe the whole thing will go up. That's negative. Look. Just enjoy your loved ones. I hope you get some good presents. I hope you didn't buy the wrong present. That's the worst thing, buying the wrong present for the people in your life, the people you love. Here's a present. Why that face? Oh, my God. Is it over? Am I an asshole? Should I go hang myself in the bathroom with the present I bought you? Will that sweater work its way into a noose? So, I got back from Atlanta the other day. Down there a week, and I think some of the scenes, a lot of times I don't know if I'm doing a good job, and I don't know if acting is fun or it's a job, or if it, I don't know what I'm doing sometimes. But by the third day, when I was doing scenes with Jennifer Hudson and Marlon Wayans, it was pretty good. We had some we had some good times, had some good laughs, and you know, Jennifer's very pleasant. It was good to hang out with Marlon, who's a comedian as well, and have some laughs. But I'll tell you, the last night of the shoot, you know, they were long days. They're, you know, at least 12-hour days, and the final dinner was sort of a Christmas party where a lot of the people that had already been shooting, some of the kids came, and who were in the movie, and the caterers did a there was lobster tails and filet mignon and stuff, but it was catering and being on a film set is a full diversity of people with different jobs, all different levels of jobs, all for different types of people. And it was just sort of a communal kind of event. It's not, you know, it wasn't orchestrated in any way. There's a food line, a buffet, but they had brought in some local people to sing Christmas carols. There's someone playing piano and a few people singing that they had brought in. And this kind of like, it was sort of a mess hall vibe. And then Jennifer Hudson came in, and they don't, you know, the big stars, they don't always eat with us littler stars and the gaffers and the sound people and the makeup people. They sometimes just eat in their trailer. They have their special food, but it was sort of a Christmas thing. She came. Now, when you're Jennifer Hudson and there's people at microphones singing songs, you're going to be pressured to maybe sing a song. And she didn't seem to want to do it at first. I was kind of watching it. And she didn't, but it was kind of interesting because they were singing, one of the Jesus songs. And I saw her just sort of kind of moving in, but being pulled in by the music, not by the need to entertain or by the need to perform, but by, she just, when singing is what you do and there's the possibility to do some singing, you get pulled to do it. And I saw her gradually move up there, and I've not seen her perform. I don't know her work, really. I know she's got a great voice. But I'll tell you, man, I mean, when she got on the mic and started singing sort of with this other woman in a harmony, like, it just brings fucking tears to your eyes. Singing for me sometimes, especially a spiritual or a standard or whatever, but to hear her effortlessly do what she does right there in just a disorganized little room where people are eating dinner at a buffet, it was just very moving. I got all choked up. I don't even know where it came from, but it was pretty fucking awesome. And I'll tell you, the sets look great. Everything, the period looks great. It turned out to be pretty great experience down there, and I'm going back after New Year's. So I just wanted to give you a update on that situation, the Respect movie. Again, you never know how much of you is going to end up in the movie, but it started to get comfortable towards the end there. And I got home here, and Monkey and Buster are okay. I'd been gone a week, but there was people here at the house the whole time I was gone, so they had people. And I'm trying not to project sadness onto my cats now that Fonda is gone. But it's hard, you know. Monkey's old as well. He's 15 plus years. And he's like, you know, the medicine's working for the hyperthyroid, and he seems good. His weight's good. His energy's good. And Buster's fat. Can't get him to eat wet food, but he eats the dry kidney food. But they both seem a lot more sociable. Well, Monkey's been very warm, but Buster's a little... Maybe it's just now Buster can get equal attention. I really paid a lot of attention to my older cats, to the original crew, than I did him. And I don't know, they seem okay. I'm just trying not to look at Monkey and think he's sad. Okay? So Merry Christmas. I'm a Jew. My guest, Jimmy Tingle, I go way back with Jimmy, actually. I mean, it's not like we were close, but I always knew Jimmy. He's one of those Boston guys. He's definitely a political comic, but he's sort of a everyman guy. And, you know, he went into politics a bit. He ran for office in Boston, I think, for lieutenant governor. I'll talk to him about that. But, you know, his story is sort of interesting. He was a bartender at one of the original kind of Boston comedy venues. But he's just always been there. Jimmy Tingle. Fucking Jimmy Tingle. And he's here today. He's got a big gig at the Wilbur Theater in Boston this Saturday, December 28th. It's Jimmy Tingle's 2020 Vision. And you can go to jimmytingle.com for tickets and all things Jimmy. And this is me. He flew out to do a couple of things out here, this being one of them. It was a real pleasure to catch up with Jimmy Tingle. But you flew in from Logan?
Yes. Yes. Beautiful Logan Airport.
It's so funny. Yeah, I know. I flew into Boston not too long ago to do the show, the Schubert. And it's been I don't go there often.
Right.
But I spent a lot of time there in my life. And I don't recognize, you know, this. It's like a new tunnel. There's a new bridge.
Yep.
It doesn't seem like the same airport. It's better.
Yeah.
Right?
Oh, yeah.
They changed everything.
Yeah. It's built up a lot over the last 20 years. It really has.
But what part did you grow up in?
Cambridge.
You grew up in Cambridge?
Yeah.
Like in Project
Born
Cambridge?
Born and raised. No.
Is it one of those hard luck Irish tales?
No.
Where'd you grow up?
Right in the middle. Right in the middle. Yeah. In between, well, if you know the city, you know Central Square.
Yep.
And you know Inman Square where the Ding Ho was.
Right.
I grew right up in, grew up in the middle, right in between those two squares, and then between Harvard and Kendall.
Wow.
So, yeah. So we had MIT like a mile to one side, Harvard a mile to the other side, Inman Square two blocks one way, Central Square two blocks the other way. So I was right in the middle.
And do you from a big family?
Big, I'm the oldest of four. Big Italian family. I'm half Italian.
You are?
Yeah. So my mother is from the city.
I have, she's I from have no Cambridge. Idea.
She's, yeah. And she's got a big family. She was the youngest of 10.
What's her maiden name?
Diguglielmo.
Diguglielmo?
Diguglielmo. D-E capital G-U-G-L-I-E-L-M-O.
Wow. I had no idea.
Yeah.
I thought you were just one of the Irish Boston guys.
Nope. Half Italian. My father is from the South, actually. He's from North Carolina. So he's English, Irish, Scottish, Swedish. And so he's Protestant.
Yeah.
And so they met, you know, via their actual siblings. My mother's brother married my father's sister.
Oh,
and they met
it.
During the war. It's a long story, but they met down in North Carolina. She was a waitress, and he was stationed there. He was in the Marines. Yeah,
it's so funny because, like, I don't know why I made the assumption just because of, you know, the McDonald's and the Sweeneys. And
sure.
The, and
no, people make that assumption.
You assume
all the
like
time.
You must be from the Irish immigrants,
right?
You must.
Yeah, like we're from the Italian immigrants.
From everybody. Oh yeah,
yeah.
Your mother came over.
Oh
from,
yeah, not her parents did. Yeah, her mother did when she was like.
And
three.
They ended up in Cambridge.
Yeah, they settled there. It was not far from the North End, actually.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, when they were growing up, they went to the North End to church
because
there was no Italian church in East Cambridge, and it was like a mile walk. You know, not too far, but it was that whole area.
Well, it's interesting because so you're the oldest of four.
Yeah.
And they ever with anyone else in show business? Anyone else make that mistake?
No. I started in the open mics, Mark, with you, you know.
I remember, look,
80, 81, right?
Well, I mean, it would be you.
You were at BU.
No, this was earlier. See, because I remember, I vaguely remember the first time maybe I went to the Ding Ho, because I didn't really start performing stand-up until like the summer of 84.
Okay.
Like, you know, when I was at BU.
Okay.
Really. But in 81, like, I remember going to the Ding Ho, maybe, and you were like a bartender there still?
Yeah.
Is that possible?
Yeah. I was a bartender, daytime bartender and open mic performer, and I was doing open mics and did one open mic, fell in love with the place, told Lenny, I knew Lenny from high school.
Lenny Clark?
Yeah. I knew him from high school.
You knew him from high school?
I did, yeah. He was we went to the same high school.
In Cambridge?
Yeah. Cambridge Latin.
Did they grow up there?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Yeah.
Lenny Clark.
Yeah.
Mark Clark.
And he was hosting
Mike
the
Clark.
Yeah. He was hosting the Wednesday night open mic night. I did it. It had a blast doing
but
it.
Did
and
you
I
work?
Got a job there.
Oh, okay. So that's how that happened.
Yeah.
But before that, were you just, what were you doing? Were you a troublemaker?
No.
In high school? Because Lenny seems like he would have been a troublemaker.
Lenny was the class president.
No kidding.
Yes. No, I knew Lenny. We played sports together. He was on the
Lenny
football
Clark
team.
Was the class president.
Yeah, of his
he
class.
He started
in
politics. You ended in it.
Yeah.
How'd that happen?
I don't know, man.
He was a popular kid, huh?
Nah, he was just, you know, he was the class president.
Yeah.
He was always a sort of a leader,
uh-huh.
You know? And he was into politics, yeah. And so,
no kidding.
So I knew him. So when he was hosting the open mic nights,
But what were you, in college? Did you go to college before you entered?
Yeah. But he was, you know, when I got out of school, I lived in the neighborhood.
In undergrad.
History, education. Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah. You know what got me into it, really? It was the movie Lenny. When the movie Lenny came out,
sure.
It was like
Dustin Hoffman, Lenny Bruce.
Yeah. That was an awesome movie. And then, of course, Saturday Night Live was on the
air. Who were your favorite comics, though, at that time?
Before I started,
like
probably Lenny Lenny Bruce.
Yeah.
But as a kid, Jackie Gleason, the Honeymooners.
Right.
You know,
those
guys were great.
Yeah.
Hot Connie.
Yeah.
Watching those guys
But you
every
didn't watch
Sunday
much
night.
Stand-up when you were a kid?
Not a lot, no.
Yeah.
Let me think. Not really.
Yeah.
But as we got older, you know, with Saturday Night Live, and they came on the air, and then the movie Lenny, and then it just started, the whole scene started in Boston. Really, my major influences were
the local guys.
The local guys, theoretically, the Lenny Bruce type, trying to say something and make people laugh at the same time. I was always into that. I thought it was a great format.
Yeah, I remember I remember going there. Like, I don't know if I was, I can't remember the year, but I remember Lenny would, I must have been on a Lenny Clark night. I don't think I performed, but I remember you were probably still drinking. You were kind of sweaty. And you had a harmonica.
Yeah.
Through most of it.
Oh, yeah.
You did
I did songs. When I first started, I didn't really know what I was doing. I had a trench coat. I was trying to do like a Blues Brothers thing. I had shades, sunglasses.
Yeah, right.
I had a beard, natural, long hair. Trench coat.
Really?
Yeah. Trench coat, hat, sunglasses.
Yeah.
I do these songs. I'm a test tube baby. I'm a test tube baby. That's why I got the blues.
Was that like the test tube baby song?
Yeah, the test tube baby blues.
Yeah.
And just song parodies, things like that. When I first started, and doing the open mic nights.
Well, like, who was, like, what year are we talking, 81?
80.
80.
80,
so, like,
81.
And that was really the beginning of the Ding Ho scene?
Yeah, 79,
so
80.
So, it was, who
Barry
was
Barry Crimmins.
Barry Crimmins and Lenny Clark.
Barry was the sort of the founder.
Yeah.
And Lenny was doing the open mics on Wednesdays.
Oh, okay,
and then,
so it was really Barry's brainchild.
Yeah.
And Barry at that time was also a sweaty, angry, politically driven, smoking cigarettes madman, but always political, correct?
Pretty much.
Yeah.
Yeah. We all kind of evolved.
Right,
into
sure.
It. You know, you find out what you're good at and what you like. You
but
know,
who
you're
was
driven
around?
By passion.
Yeah.
Who was around?
At the very
Poundstone,
beginning.
Paula Poundstone, Stephen Wright, Jack Gallagher, Steve Sweeney, Mike McDonald, Mike Donovan.
They were all coming in?
They were
the
all.
Ding?
Oh, yeah.
That was the original crew.
Lauren Dombrowski.
Oh, yeah.
Dennis Leary.
Yeah. Really?
Bobby Goldthwaite relocated
were there. Early,
there. Kenny Rogerson moved to town.
But they were at the Ding?
Yeah.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah.
I remember Kenny. I remember, but this is, you're saying 1980,
81? 81. They probably got there. Goldthwaite probably got there, 82, 83, maybe.
Yeah.
Paula was there, and she went to San Francisco pretty
early on. A lot
of
them did. Like, who went? Kevin Meaney?
Yeah. He came from San Francisco. I think he came from San Francisco.
And he went back?
No, he stayed in Boston for a long time. He made a big mark.
I think he influenced a lot of people.
Yeah.
You know, that sort of persistence of him.
You know what he did? Mm. Yeah, he and Sweeney had a great thing, the Sweeney Meany Night.
Yeah, I remember
and
that.
They would do that.
At Stitches?
Yes. And they really brought a form of improv to stand up. There really wasn't, it was always like you either did improv or you did stand up. But those guys would go on together and they just had a blast and it was all off the top of the head.
Yeah, I remember.
Off the cuff. And he'd go out in the street
with
the mic and they'd follow him with the camera.
That's
and
right.
Show it on the screen in Stitches.
I remember that.
And it was hilarious.
It was funny. And Meany just had he had this cadence and this pace.
Yeah,
he was not going to not let you laugh.
Right.
He was just going to keep pushing. And Kenny too.
And he always dressed up too.
Yeah,
he was always dressed up.
And bow tie. Sometimes
I think so.
But the blazer.
He always had the blazer.
Yep.
He often had a tie.
Yep.
Sometimes I think a bow tie.
Yep.
And he looked so different than the audience.
Yep.
For the most part, in those at that time.
Those crazy times. And Donovan was so funny.
Yeah.
I used to go to Play It Against Sam's to watch people. Chris Collins.
Yeah.
Oh, man, he was scary.
And Chance.
Chance Langdon.
Chance was down to Play It Against Sam's. Barry Katz was the booker.
Why do people suck?
Yeah.
Why do people suck? DJ Bob Lazarus, Rich Seisler.
Yep.
You know, Kylie.
Yep, Kylie, yeah.
Brian Kylie, right? He started there. And there were other guys that were just come and
comics.
Go. Yeah, a lot of them.
Yeah.
Yeah, there was some crazy shit. So, all right, so you...
But it wasn't an industry town, Mark. You know?
No, I know, but it became a regional powerhouse.
Yes.
Because it was one of the few places where you could actually make a living.
Yep.
Because of the one-nighters, that Mike Clark,
yeah.
Barry Katz,
yeah.
You know, Roger Paul. Well,
there were all these gigs all over the place that you could make a couple $100 on a Wednesday night, you know?
But I remember so let's go through the arc of it. So do you remember when Stephen Wright first showed up?
Yeah. No, he was there before me.
Oh, he was?
Yeah, I remember the night, though, he got booked for The Tonight Show.
That's a big deal, right?
It was a big deal. Peter LaSalle was coming into town. Yeah. His daughter was working at going to Emerson.
Yeah.
And he called the Ding Ho. I was the daytime bartender. So he called the Ding Ho and he wants directions. He says, I'm coming in. I want to put up to. He had arranged this previously with Barry.
Right.
But he said, I'm coming from Emerson. How do I get to the Ding Ho in Inman Square? And I'm going, well, you go down Cambridge Street, you take a right in Inman Square, Springfield Street, go into the parking lot. Anyway, but. What happened, they set up an audition that night.
Yeah.
And I remember I got a gig out of it because I didn't make the cut to be on that level. I wasn't on that level. But they had to cancel a gig and, you know, they had a couple of comics booked in New Haven.
Right, right.
So I got the gig in New Haven. Right. So that was cool. I got $200.
You took a ride?
Yeah, I took a ride. Me and Tommy Gilmore. Chance, I think, might have been in it.
It's Tom Gilmore.
Yeah.
Wow.
So anyway, we went to New Haven, but Peter LaSalle came in, saw, you know, 15 comics, top people, and, you know, loved Wright.
And that was that.
And the next night, they put him on The Tonight Show.
It was the next night?
It was the next night or the night after.
No kidding. That's
Stephen
quick.
Will tell you exactly. Yeah, it was like within 2 or 3 days, and then Johnny wanted him back the next night.
That's crazy.
So it was fun watching it. We all watched it in the back room.
It's inspirational.
Oh, yeah.
So
oh, yeah.
Now, where does the booze play into the, like, you know, how do you, are you
Everybody
pretty...
was drinking.
Are you...
Everybody was drinking. That was part of the deal. Barry ran the place. Barry Cremens. Our deal with the Chinese restaurant was that the comics drink for free.
Right.
So
you and Kenny.
All of us.
Hard drinking.
You know, all of us.
Meanie. Yeah.
You know, and it was free. And
there were some guys that didn't drink as much as others, but there were some that drank a lot.
Yeah.
But I think Kenny's sober now.
Yeah, Kenny's sober. Yeah. And quitting drinking was a huge thing. Quitting drinking.
But
was
let's get through it. So you just walk. You're working regionally. You're doing. Yeah. You're closing with the harmonica.
Well, you know, I eventually dropped it. I did it for about six months or so.
Oh, that was it.
Yeah, I didn't do it very long.
Yeah,
maybe a year.
But you're doing the regional gigs.
Yeah, regional gigs coming down to New York. Remember Comedy Tonight?
Yeah,
that was cool. Yeah. Bill Boggs.
Yeah,
Early '80s.
Oh, where it was a real TV show.
Yeah, the first one.
Was that in New York or in Boston?
Yeah, that was in New York.
Comedy Tonight, right, and he had this big head. I remember, you know, you'd sit there with him. I remember it was one of the first experiences of seeing someone who was on television up close for me. Mm-hmm. Like, to be on TV and to realize, like, wow, makeup really hides a lot of this shit, you know? That's what I remember about Bill Boggs.
Yeah.
It was like an interview show, right?
When I did it, it was basically stand-up. You did, like, 5 minutes.
But didn't you talk to the guy?
3 minutes. I don't remember if I talked. Yeah, I think so. I think so. But anyway, that was, like, a first, like, TV thing.
That was your first TV thing?
Yeah. The Comedy Time. And a lot of comics did it. All the comics in New York did it.
In the mid-'80s?
Yeah, but even earlier, I think.
Right.
Yeah, probably 83, 84.
And then did you end up doing, like, Caroline's?
Caroline's.
And Evening at the Improv?
I think I did one of those. I'm not sure if I did Evening at the Improv, but Caroline's Star Search.
Yeah.
Remember when they had the Star Search auditions?
I didn't do it. Yeah, you did it?
Oh, yeah, I did it with Meanie. Meanie did it.
But I
lost to Evan Davis
my first time.
Yes. But Ed McMahon's daughter would come up. She came up and
where?
Really to Cambridge, to Boston.
Yeah.
Saw everybody at Stitches.
Yeah.
And of course, they're looking for a TV act who can work clean for three minutes or 2 minutes or whatever it was. I got it. Meanie got it. I think maybe Jack Gallagher. I'm not sure.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
It's so funny. Those guys are like, I can't do 3 minutes clean.
I know. That's what I mean about not being an industry town. It was just freelance.
How
man.
The fuck?
Nobody
am I
was trying to get on television because there was no television.
How am I going to do 3 minutes?
That's why when Wright got on, it was such a momentous thing.
Yeah.
Because all of a sudden, holy, you know, people can actually go to another level. You can actually be a pro.
Yeah. Tom Gilmore, I just placed him. Like, because I knew the name, and it took me a while to get his face.
Yeah.
Did that guy, is he still doing it?
Yeah, he's still around. Yeah.
Yeah.
Great joke writer. People like Brian Kiley, unbelievable writers.
Oh, for sure. So when
just
did you
hilarious.
Start talking about politics, though?
Honestly,
it's a big shift from song parody to politics.
Yeah, but even the song parodies had something to them.
Right.
They were just, you know, it was a very low level attempt at social commentary. But I just, you know, what happens is, as you know, you kind of gravitate with what you're interested in.
Right.
You know, you just kind of go with, like in college, I studied sociology and history.
Yeah.
You know, and I was into minored in education, so I was interested in politics.
Did you ever teach?
I was interested in current events. No, but I was technically a certified teacher.
No kidding.
When I graduated, I was certified in Massachusetts. I never did actually teach, though.
Because I remember there was a period there, I guess in the 80s, where, where there was sort of a small heyday for political comics, and there was only a few of them.
Yeah.
Because there was like that record. Weren't you on that record
with
Strange Bedfellows?
Yes.
It was you and Crimmins and Durst.
Me, Crimmins, Durst, and Randy Credico.
Randy Credico.
Yeah.
That was like a big deal, that CD.
That was 88. Yeah.
That was 88. That was that late into
it.
I think. So by that time, you had sort of like established yourself. You wore a blazer, you know, and you were, you know, kind of a straight up kind of populist politics guy.
Yeah, well, it started probably...
It's populist, the word I want. Proletariat, working class, meat and potatoes.
Yeah.
Wait, come on, people. What the fuck is going on here?
Yeah, so I think so.
So when does that? When do you start really kind
of... Well, common sense, you know, is another way of just common sense. But it was probably 80, you know, I quit drinking 87, 88.
So how did that happen?
Yeah, how did it happen? How did it happen?
Well, I mean, like,
people started going downhill, man. People started going downhill, you know? And that's what happened. Last year, the drinking, you know, three friends died, three funerals.
Really?
That I was using with. And it just, you know, it's like, holy shit, you know, party's over.
What are you doing, blow and booze?
It's just, you know,
and regular just, shit.
Yeah, and feeling like you're dying yourself, you know?
Yeah.
I started calling places. And this is actually one of the reasons I eventually ran for office, because of the need who we have right now for people to get into treatment.
Oh, no
kidding. It's like, anyway, so I'm calling places. This is Christmas 87, December 87, and I'm getting the runaround.
Oh, you hit the bottom in Christmas?
Yeah, mid-December, you know, going out Christmas shopping, can't get past noon, can't get to the stores.
Yeah.
You got a big, all this cash, I want to do this Christmas shopping, I need a drink, you know, you can't drink and you can't not drink.
So were you like you were kind of really dug in with the addiction, like, you know, you woke up, you drank kind of shit?
At the end, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
You had to feel normal, to feel normal.
Right, right.
You know, just to take the edge off.
How old were you?
I was early 30s.
Yeah.
Early
so you 30s. You'd had a pretty good go of it.
Yeah. Well, you know, the drinking age turned 18 when I turned 18 the same month.
Yeah. You had to start.
And, yeah, man. And it was like a new sport. It was a new sport.
Yeah.
Everybody was, you know, it was just a new sport and everybody, it started off so much fun, as you know, right?
Oh, yeah.
It starts off so much fun and then bad shit happens, you know?
And also when you live in the life. You know, that, like, it's one thing when you're in high school or college, but when you're doing like comedy and you're living the life.
Oh, man.
Where you fucking go and you're drinking before you go on, then after you go on, you get the free drinks, and there's no reason to get up during the day. You're just fucked.
And they're giving you money.
Yeah.
And you're making money.
you know? Yeah.
And you're like, you're going, you're like in your own little world. You're like your own little rock star in this own little place, right?
In Boston, it was sort of easy, especially for you guys who come out of there, to be rock stars. I mean, you got work. I mean, I remember working there when I had to open for dudes. I don't remember driving you anywhere.
Yeah.
But you know, I drove around. That's how I started.
What were you there, Mark, doing that? In the mid-80s, late 80s?
Yeah, I mean, I won, you know, I came in second in the riot in 88, right?
Okay.
So that's when I started working.
Okay.
Right, so then I had my 25, 30 minutes, and Barry was giving me work opening for the two-man shows.
Yeah.
You know, I'd drive a headliner and go do a half hour in
Barry
Maine.
Katz?
Yeah, for Boston Comedy Company.
Right.
But that's really how I first started paying my dues, was doing the half hour slot in front of the 45 minute closer on those road gigs.
Right.
And I drove the best of them.
Yeah.
I was there for the Johnny E's. I did them all.
Oh, yeah.
Pancho Villa's and Lemonster. I did the Taunton Regency. I was there, man. Yeah. I was there.
How about the, what's the one in Plymouth? The the Naughty Pine.
Sure.
The Naughty Pine.
Oh, no.
That was I think it was Plymouth or Quincy.
That was a connection room, right?
And there was another one, Charlie something's, where they got the Bruins on behind you.
Yeah, yeah.
And you're in the middle of your act, and someone scores a goal, and everybody cheers.
Yeah, it's a fucking, with the Naughty Pine. That was a long-running one.
Yeah, that ran for
remember
a while.
Remember the Tipperary?
Yeah.
The Tipperary one? I remember I did the Tipperary pub.
Yeah.
Where I don't even remember what part of Boston that was in, but I did it with Bob Seibel.
Yeah.
Madman.
Rest in peace.
Rest in peace, a lot of them now, huh?
Yeah.
But
anyway, I was in New York by the time you started doing that. I was already in New York.
Right, I remember. But you start calling people on to get sober, and you couldn't get hold of anybody?
No. I was calling detoxes, rehabs, treatment centers.
And nothing?
Eventually, I got in. Yeah. Cambridge City Hospital. Yeah. The man said, and how unusual is this? I said, listen, man, I really need help. And he said, you called the right place. I went in. Stayed 7 days through Christmas, 1987. Yeah. I got out. I moved to New York. I focused on stand-up comedy and recovery. And that's all I did for a year. A year later, to the week, I went on The Tonight Show with Johnny.
No kidding.
Yeah. And it was like, and my friend Colin Quinn said, Jimmy, if you stop drinking, man, you can really be a good comic.
He was there for you,
he
Colin.
Was, yeah.
Solid
yeah.
recovery guy.
Yeah.
Yeah,
he was really helpful.
So that's amazing because I know where you lived. Because there's this weird thing, and I think we talked about it off the mics once before. I remember when Frankie Bastille moved to Boston.
Yep.
He kind of grabbed onto me. I was his lackey.
Yeah.
And I'm driving him around. And I didn't know he was strung out. I didn't know about dope and heroin and shit. And I remember one time we did a gig in like Mystic, Connecticut or somewhere. And he's like, let's stop at Tingles. You know, down at you, because you're living on the Lower East Side, right?
In New York, yeah.
So I don't know if you remember this, but it was sort of weirdly embarrassing because I didn't realize what was happening. He went and scored dope.
Yeah.
And then he did some.
Yeah.
And then he's like, he's pouring sweat.
Yeah.
He's out of his fucking mind. His girlfriend, Karen, she's nodding out. And he's like, let's go visit Tingle. And we go knock on your door, and you're on your way out to do a gig at some restaurant or something. You're all dressed up, but you're like, and Frankie's like, I got to take a shower.
Yeah.
And you let him show, and then you left.
Yeah.
And then we left. It was the weirdest thing.
How can you not trust Frankie Bastille when he wants to take a shower?
He never stole from me, but you know, he was a hustler.
Yeah.
But I didn't realize how, like,
he was a road warrior.
Yeah, for sure. But I didn't realize that's what we were there for. I was driving him to pick up dope, and he needed to take a shower because he was all sweaty and burning up.
Yeah.
But you were very kind.
The Lower East Side, I was down on I was on Clinton Street. This is like 88, 89, 90.
Yeah, that's when I was driving around. This is my first couple years of stand-up, when I was driving headliners to gigs.
Right.
And I didn't know nothing. I didn't know anything about the Lower East Side. It was chaos then.
Yeah, it was.
I eventually lived there. I mean, in 89, I ended up on second between A and B.
Right.
So when you got to...
Hicks was down there at that time.
He didn't... Was he in the Lower East Side, though?
Yeah.
He didn't last long there, because I remember hanging out with him a couple times. He didn't love New York.
Yeah.
It wasn't like... It was hard to watch him in New York, because New Yorkers, like, they don't give a fuck how, you know, like, if you're going to be all angry, you better have a pretty good reason. You know what I'm saying? So they'd watch Hicks and be like, why is he yelling? You know, like, you got... Like, you know, and if you're... With Bill, you can't... It's got to be longer than 15 minutes.
Yeah.
Man, or you're not going to get the gist of it.
Yeah.
But I remember when he was there, we spent New Year's Eve. It was probably New Year's Eve 90 or 90. Yeah, maybe. Was that about right? About 90?
I think he was there 90.
Right.
It was everybody worked the catch.
Right. I was mostly, I couldn't really get on a catch, and I refused to kiss Lewis's ass. I couldn't stand him. So I was at the old improv, the original improv.
Okay.
Like on 44th Street.
Right.
And it's slow decay.
Right.
And that's where Hicks was. I remember Hicks walked in. It was New Year's Eve. We all just didn't know what we were going to do. And like, he's like, come on, let's go look at the ball. And I'm like, all right. And it was me and Vitaly and Hicks. And we got about a mile away from the fucking thing and just hit a wall of people. And he's like, fuck this. Let's go back to the improv. That was New Year's Eve with Bill Hicks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But he was there, but it was pretty wild.
So you moved down there in 88?
I moved down in 80, yeah, moved down there in 88. So we did that album with Barry and Randy, and
you had a little juice, yeah, a little traction with that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was good to do, absolutely.
So when you got down to New York, where you got out, you were already working at Catch, or you had to wait around?
I was working at Catch. It's an industry town, as you know, and things can happen, you know? HBO special, half-hour specials, when they were doing those.
I did HBO half-hour. Yeah. Did we do in the same, I don't think we did the same run. I did mine 95.
Yeah. I did it, I think it was 91.
So when you're 92. There, though, like, so you're there 88, and, like, you know, I got there in 89, and that's when they're shooting. You do the Caroline's Comedy Hour shooting there.
Yep, did that.
Right, and then
the down at the Seaport, right?
The Seaport was the first one. Then she shot them at the other place when she moved, yeah.
Right.
But the first ones I did at the Seaport.
Right.
Right, and that weird little, kind of looked like a nursery school set. Mm-hmm. It was just the colors were kind of, the whole place was kind of odd. But yeah, so then... Are you headlining on the road starting in the late 80s? Is that the deal?
You know what I'm doing? I'm headlining on the road.
Yeah.
Headlining on the road. And then the one-man shows started. Uh-huh. Jackie Mason.
Right.
Saw Jackie Mason in 89 in New York. Mm-hmm. And saw a guy in his element on stage in a theater in New York, 2,500 people.
Yeah.
Do you know what it's like to be in a theater and 2,500 people are laughing hysterically?
Yeah.
I don't either, but... anyway, Jackie Mason's there, and he's just killing it, and he's doing what he loves to do. He's just being himself.
Right.
And I said, that's what I want to do.
You want to do the one-man show.
I just started working on that format. I just liked it. I left the theater that night just really inspired, and I just said, that's what I want to do.
Yeah.
Work alone, because the more political you're getting, like you were saying about the crowds in New York, right?
Right.
You know, you're doing 15 minutes, and they're kind of trying to get away from the news, and,
right,
you know.
Yeah, and it's also like, you know, in order to do political comedy effectively, you know, you have to, they have to understand your point of view outside of just political jokes. So it takes a minute to dig in.
Yeah.
So, okay, so you knew right away that the long form one-man show.
I liked it.
Yeah, so when did you do your first one? I'm trying to remember.
I just started working out in the Village, Barry's place, doing the Boston Comedy Club. You know, three people.
Sure.
One night, Irvin Arthur came. He was so kind. Irvin Arthur came. He was my agent at the time. He brought Michael Green, Michael Green's sister, and Henny Youngman, right? And I'm doing,
remember that. What year is that, 89?
This is like 89, 90 something.
And that's when I'm working there.
And I'm saying to Irv, I want to, you know, do the one-man show. You got to help me. He goes, all right, I'll come down and watch it, you know? So there's no one in there except those four people. I'm doing like 90 minutes. At one point, I turn around, and Henny is out. He's just sleeping.
Well, he was like 100.
Yeah.
But he was
out. He was out.
But so you were doing them, you were running it like before, like at 6 or 7 o'clock before they do the evening shows?
I was probably, maybe a Monday night or a Sunday night or something. It was an off night.
See, that's where you'd workshop it.
Yeah, go there and I was just into it.
The worst. Isn't it hard to do for nobody, though?
It is.
Did it help you to do it for nobody?
It did. It did help me. And it helped me just to do it, mine was basically a long set.
Right.
It was a long set of stand-up, and it was, you know, but that's what I was doing. But the other thing is, if you're doing something that's social and political, or trying to relevant, you know, you just need to, like you said,
stretch out.
You need to stretch out. You need to just get it out. And it was all motivated. And the other thing is, newly sober, you're trying to work clean.
How was that for you?
It was hard.
What about it?
It was hard. Nerves.
Yeah.
Just uncomfortable on stage.
Oh, yeah.
You know, when
you
first start, you're like, oh, man, look at all these people.
I know.
They're all looking at me.
No buffer. It's no buffer. Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
But then you just, you know, you just do it. And the clubs were hard. I found the clubs difficult, newly sober, to be up there, and everybody's drinking, and everybody's, you know.
Yeah.
And you're on a kind of a different thing. And so anyway, that's one of the reasons I just gravitated towards theater, more and more social and political. 89 was an amazing year historically. The wall's coming down, and all this stuff is happening with the end of the Cold War. And people are just, there was just this inspirational feeling that was in the air, you know, that I felt. And I just was into it.
Yeah,
you know?
And when did Carson happen?
88. And so, after that, I just wanted to that's all I wanted to do.
Did it help you, the Carson, at that time?
It did.
Yeah?
Yeah, it helped a lot. Got an agent from it, got to work on the road.
Yeah.
You know, it led to HBO, the half-hour special, things like that. You're just out there.
Sure,
you know, and it was
sure.
the only show. I mean, I think Letterman was just on. When was Letterman on?
No, he's 86. On.
Yeah, he had been on, yeah.
A couple years, yeah.
Yeah.
He came on, I think, 84 or something.
Yeah. Maybe. But anyway, it was good. But it was moving. I was just very passionate towards the one-man show.
Yeah, format. And that so in 89, that was sort of what you did. You kept building one-man shows.
Just kept doing it, did it down in New York.
What did you do, like a run somewhere? Did you get to do an off-Broadway run?
Yeah, I did the American Place Theater. Jack Rollins actually helped me out.
Jack Rollins and his eyebrows. I remember I've met him before. He had these colossal eyebrows.
What a manager.
I met Jack Rollins and it didn't go well. But he was old already, but he was definitely a powerful guy. Yeah. And he came and saw it?
Oh, he came and saw it and wanted to help. Helped me, invested in it.
He did?
Yeah, he did. He liked it. He liked the point of view. Yeah. He liked what I was trying to do.
Right.
And he was just, you know, he loved the comics.
Whoever he managed was just
in their corner 100%. He would come with me to radio shows, and he was in his late 70s at the time.
So he was managing you?
Yeah, for a little while, about a year or so. But just was completely invested in the show, and we did it off-Broadway at the American Place Theater. And, you know, you do it for a couple of months, and if it doesn't really take off, we got great reviews in the New York Times, but it never went to the next level,
right.
a long Broadway run or anything like that. But it was great to come back up to Boston and work there and started producing myself. I mean, just doing your own thing. Like you've done with the podcast.
Sure.
You make your own breaks, take the initiative. I started renting out theaters.
Well, when did you do the, I remember there's a big deal. I guess that was much later. Because I remember, you got 60 Minutes later.
Yeah.
But you start doing the theater. Was that the Boston Bake Theater?
No.
When did you have that residency there? You know what I did?
I went up to Boston after I got out of New York.
I rented.
I moved back.
After the run at the American Playhouse.
Yeah, after the American Place Theater.
Were you bitter? Were you sad?
No,
dejected?
No. I just felt like, my father had passed away. My mother was in disarray. You know, there was family reasons to move back. My girlfriend lived there at the time, was now my wife. There was a lot of reasons. But the other thing is I didn't want to go back into the clubs, and I wanted to get on stage, and I felt I could do well up in Boston if I could get a theater. And I rented the Hasty Pudding Theater.
Yeah.
And I rented it and produced myself. I learned how to produce
myself. Yeah, and how'd that go?
It went great. I made more money and had more, you know, it was just
people.
It brought more people, more money. You're on a different level. These are theater people coming in to see the show. And it was great, and to learn how to produce, so then you're not subject to waiting for the phone to ring.
Now, it's so funny the kind of like I guess that's why I found myself in a situation where I was driving you to a road gig or anything, because you knew enough about yourself once you got sober to know that you just didn't want to deal with the club.
It just wasn't my thing anymore.
Yeah,
you know, it was great, and I loved doing it, and I still go in. I work out all the time.
Yeah.
I go in, do 10 minutes, 15 minutes, trying to old stuff, new stuff, and I love it.
Right.
Because that's where you can get your pacing down for jokes, for TV sets or whatever.
Yeah.
So I'm a big supporter of the clubs, but just for me, the way I was going in, I was doing the Hasty Pudding Theater, and you don't have to be hilarious every 15 seconds.
Right.
You can have peaks and valleys in terms of commentary. So commentary is not a negative in the theater.
Yeah, that's right. You got a little more space.
You got space.
You
can branch out, take
not
on
a laugh
different
per minute
subjects.
Trip. Yeah.
Take on different subjects. You know how it is. When I saw your show at the Schubert, it was
like,
great, man.
Just valleys, man. Nothing but valleys.
But the thing about a theater, the valleys are very compelling.
Oh, sure. And theaters are like, they're hanging on every...
Yeah.
It's actually a problem when you do theater sometimes. It's like... Because where I tape my special is actually a legit kind of black box theater. I think the expectations of that space are heavy.
Yeah.
Right? So like the comedy thing, they're like, I don't know, it's just... You know, can we laugh? You know,
right.
Yeah, laugh. Of course you can laugh. But the older theaters. So how long did you run? Did you do a residency at Hasty Pudding?
I did like 6 months.
And what do you mean? Like you learned how to produce? What does that entail for that kind of shit?
It means finding the space.
Sure.
Putting up the money.
Yeah.
Renting it out.
Yeah.
Hiring the publicist.
Yeah.
Hiring the sound. The light. If the theater doesn't have it.
Right.
Hiring the tech people.
And then you do this at different
marketing.
Cities.
I did it there. From there, I went out to L.A. a couple of years later, did it at the Coast Playhouse in Los Angeles.
How'd that go?
That went well artistically, but it's very hard to draw people.
It is.
And I was thinking, this will be, you know, a little, I want to repeat this model in Los Angeles.
Right.
And the only issue is it's a much bigger city. People don't walk around. It's not Harvard Square.
Yeah, yeah.
So, but artistically, the reviews were really great.
Isn't it horrible, though, L.A., when you come doing something with expectations?
Oh, man.
Like, I've done that.
I moved. I brought my wife. My son was 1 year old.
You moved here?
Yeah. I was here from, what year was it? 98?
Yeah. Well, why'd you move?
To do the show. I wanted to.
Were you going to dig in for a year?
Yeah, man. I dug in and I rented the theater. I stayed 5 months, the Coast Playhouse. And you know what it was? It was an El Nino hit. It was like 98, El Nino. And the weather people are coming on and going, whatever you do, don't leave the house.
Yeah.
It's raining.
Get in the basement.
It's like
house is coming down.
And at the Coast Playhouse has a tin roof. So when it rains, you can hear it. So you're on stage and the audiences are, you know, initially they were big, but I kept feeling like it would build. But it never really built to a critical mass.
Yeah.
So we'd have like, you know, 13 people and you can hear the raindrops and I'm in a valley right, and I'm making a serious point and you hear the raindrops. But we stayed there 5 months. But I got to tell you, Mark.
You took a beating?
Took a beating financially. But artistically, very successful. Took a beating financially, but I was going back to Boston to get a gig, to do a show.
Right.
I saw a newspaper article on the plane.
Yeah.
USA Today. It said 60 Minutes 2. 60 right. Minutes is going to do a 60 Minutes 2.
Right.
And they have all their people. They have all the correspondents. The only person they don't have is the Andy Rooney guy.
Right.
And so I have been pitching myself to do commentaries in Boston and in LA to these various television stations. Let me do the Andy Rooney spot type thing.
Like on what shows? Like
just, you know, the news shows.
Not the Daily Show? Did you try
No. This was more like the network television coming out of the news, you
right,
know?
Right.
That's where I thought the topical humor would be, you
just
know, appreciated.
Yeah.
Anyway. Yeah, no one was interested, but I saw this article.
Yeah.
I called Brostein Gray, Ray Rio, and I said, Ray, please send him the tape, man.
Oh,
and
he's your manager at the time?
Yeah, and he sent him the tape, and next thing I know, well, 3 months later, ended up with an interview for the job to do the Andy Rooney spot on 60 Minutes 2, and that was awesome. That lasted a couple of years.
You were there every week?
I was there doing the you know, for the
right.
for the 9 months of the year. Yeah, for 2 years.
That's
two
great.
Seasons.
You get your insurance.
Yeah, it was great.
Go to the dentist.
You get paid. Yeah. You're staying in these great hotels in New York.
Right.
The Essex House overlooking the park.
Oh, that's...
It was great.
That's
it was great.
What a sweet thing to happen.
Yeah.
You know, like, because like, it sounds like it was like also one of those moments where, because the nature of what we do.
I was going to quit, man.
Yeah.
I was so despondent. I mean, I lost a
you
lot
were,
of money.
Right?
I made all the money that I used at the Hasty Pudding Theater. And I said, we're going to LA.
We're going to do it.
We're going to go to another level, you know, and it didn't lose all of it. But, you know, it's just, you're not making any money. And it's hard.
Was the expectation to sort of get into TV? Do you think, or did you just think you were going to be able to
get
run
a special
right.
run?
Yeah.
Be open for business.
Sure.
You know, be
sure.
open for business. Just sure. be out there
yeah.
to be working.
And then you just get lost out here.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, it went fine, but it just didn't make any money.
Right.
You know, and that's the norm.
Right.
That's, you know, it's highly unusual to make any money in theater. How do you make $1 million in theater? Start with $2 million.
It's highly unusual to make any money in show business at a certain level, man. You know what I mean? It's like when we're coming up, you know, it's just so fleeting. You know, even if you get a deal, you're like, great. And you know enough after a certain point, like, I'm not spending this money.
Yeah.
Like, I see, like, yeah, I'm fortunate to have been in this game since I was, like, 20.
Yeah.
But, you know, you see these guys, they get these deals. Remember back in the day, they'd give, like, even Lenny, like, you get these on-air commitments, and he's buying houses, Cadillacs or whatever. My buddy Tom, he bought a Cadillac for everybody. I'm like, dude.
Did he really?
Tom Rhodes. Yeah, he's like, I'm buying, you know.
Wow.
When they got the network deals.
Yeah, yeah.
They went out and spent all the money. I'm like, how do you spend that money? To this day, I'm weird about spending money.
Yeah.
Because of comic brain. I don't know how long I'm going to have this.
Right. Right.
Fuck,
I'm the
man.
Same way.
So, but the run with the 60 Minutes. Now, how did that affect the one man shows? I mean, were you able to
just been
parlay
able to keep,
that?
Yeah, just keep working. Yeah.
But did people know you from that, from 60
they
Minutes?
They did.
Yeah.
In the Boston area, primarily. Yeah. It just allowed me to keep working. Great credibility.
Yeah.
You know, great credit. It was good income. Learned about the business, and it was also at a time where that the news and the media wasn't as fractured as it is now.
Yeah.
And it wasn't advocacy journalism. Yeah. Like, I mean, they had standards. You had to, you know, it wasn't just like an automatic, oh, Jimmy's going to do a commentary. Go ahead.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't like, we're going to put this through the strainer. We're going to make sure this is right. The lighting, the sound, the commentary is what it has to be for network television following 60 Minutes episodes on Wednesday nights. So it was a much more controlled environment, much more
you were within
stronger
the,
journalistic standards.
The CBS News Corporation.
Yes.
So you were within that world.
Right. It wasn't it wasn't like the Weekend Update.
Yeah,
you know?
No, right. Yeah.
Which was great. It was just, it's just harder.
You weren't doing that. You were doing sort of socially relevant topics, right? You weren't just... Andy Rooney would talk about marbles for 10 minutes.
Right. Well, he did. He would find these interesting twists or interesting insights on the simplest things.
Yeah.
And I was definitely more politically driven in terms of larger issues. And I'm talking about, you know, everything from, you know, the death penalty to guns and, the issues of the day.
Yeah.
And that's really wasn't what the spot was for. But it lasted 2 years. And
yeah, they let you do it, huh?
Yeah. They let me do it, and it went well. And
and after that, is that when you took the residency in Somerville?
Yeah. I went back to Massachusetts. Basically, I wasn't still living there. But anyway, I wanted a place to work.
You were commuting to New York every other?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I wanted a place to work, to be on stage, to do my own thing.
Yeah.
And that theater was available, and I started renting that theater.
What was it called? The Boston
Bake? It was called the Boston Bake Theater.
I used to live in Somerville.
Yeah.
Davis Square, yeah.
Yeah, and Boston Bake Theater was right next to the Burren, the great Irish pub in Davis Square, right across the street from Red Bones, great barbecue place. Yeah. And the landlords were super, the Gorin family, and they said it's for rent, and they wanted me in there because I had somewhat of a reputation at this point. And we rented it and stayed 5 years, renamed it Jimmy Tingle's Off-Broadway Theater.
Yeah, I remember. Well, yeah, you let me do my one-man show there.
Yes.
I ran one of the one-man shows there.
Yeah.
I can't remember which one, but I definitely worked out there for a long form a few nights, I think.
You did. We brought you in. We did the unconventional comedy convention in 2004 for when the Democratic Party had their convention in Boston in 2004.
Mm-hmm.
As a matter of fact, that's when Barack Obama first made a national splash.
I remember, when he opened
for Kerry.
Yeah. Great opening spot.
Yeah.
Nailed it.
Yeah, he
blew the headliner out of the water.
Yeah, he did. It's not red state or blue state. It is the United States of America. Yeah. But anyway, we did the unconventional comedy convention there, and it was all political humor. You were there, Janine. Mm. We had Kremins.
Yeah.
We had Durst. We had Mort Saul. We had Lewis Black. We had, you know, over the course of a month.
Yeah.
We booked all these different acts there.
I wonder how Durst is doing. I think he had some
health
issues.
Yeah, I hope he's all right. Yeah. I heard he had a stroke recently. Yeah. I think he's okay.
Okay.
From what I saw on Facebook anyway.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
So we did that.
For 5 years.
5 years.
Yeah.
And you were producing everything, and you rented
it.
Were you making a living over there? Is it working out?
Yeah, I was working, but I was making a living in other ways as well, because I could do other shows, my own shows. But
you book it out, right? I mean, did you have just a straight up comedy night or two, or no?
We had theater, we had music, theater. It was a lot of different things. It wasn't just a comedy club.
Right.
And which is, you know, for the broader picture is good, but for marketing and for making money is probably not the best way to do it.
A variety house?
Yeah, it was more of a variety. I mean, we'd have your one-person show, we'd have a band, we'd have a night of poetry slam, it was more of an alt place.
Yeah.
You know, but it was great. We did the Ding Ho reunion there a couple of times.
Oh, yeah.
That was funny. We had Kremins down there and, you know, Steve Wright.
Yeah.
We did a lot of stuff. By the way, one of the guys I forgot to mention about the Ding Ho was Gavin.
Oh, yeah, of course.
The great Don Gavin.
I think I'm going to interview him in a couple months.
Oh, good.
I love Gavin.
Yeah, yeah.
He was really something, man.
Yeah, he was. But we had all those folks there. But it was good. But you learn the business. You know, you can make your own breaks and you do what you want
to
do.
Well, how'd that come to a close?
It came to a close because the lease was up after 5 years, and the choice was, do you want to go for another 5 years? I had it like you could extend every year.
Right.
So I didn't have to sign in for 5 years. But after 5 years, I had to re-up for another 5 years, and I didn't want to do it.
Right.
I was tired.
Now, where did you find time? Because I know that, like, at some point, you went to Harvard?
I got out of there, yeah. When I left the theater, I was looking for things to do, and I was just saying, you know, I want to do something that has more, I don't know, maybe more of an impact, you know?
That was the big shift, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Where you started thinking about actually being involved in politics.
Yeah, I wanted to learn more. I felt like maybe I'd like to run for office or do something, or try to use entertainment for purposes beyond just entertainment.
Yeah.
Right, to do something that has some sort of a meaning. Because you know how it is. We do our shows, and you could talk about the greatest ideas in the world, and then the show's over.
Right.
And everybody goes their separate ways.
Right, and whatever. And what is, how are you actually invested? You know, it's very, it's because there's a way that we think sometimes. It's like, hey, I'm talking about stuff, right? I make an impact by saying things. Yeah. But, you know, the people that really make an impact get their, you know, they roll their sleeves up and they're in it.
Right.
They're doing the work.
Right.
And we're just sort of like, hey, I hate that guy and this sucks. And yeah, hey, yeah, I hope I change some minds out there. Thank you.
Yeah. But not that everybody who's doing that is that superficial about it. But but it's not, the art form's not designed for calls to action necessarily.
Yeah. Right.
But the Kennedy School, I just kept meeting people. They said, what are you doing now, Jimmy? I said, I don't know. They said, you should check out the Kennedy School.
And what is it? What is it exactly?
It's the School of Government, Harvard Kennedy
School
of Government.
But anyone can get
it's a master's degree. No, it's a master's.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to be condescending.
Yeah.
They let you
anybody
in.
Can go
you
in.
Just, we just call up.
You know what, Mark? It's funny. When that place first came on the map in 78, I can remember walking by and very much in a very despondent, very active mode in 78, because I still lived in Cambridge at the time.
It's right by the water, right? It's like two blocks up.
Yeah, yeah, and I got like one of the admission booklets.
Right, right.
And I'm looking through
yeah,
it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I go, man, I'd love to go here someday. But anyway, so after 2007, when the theater closed, people said, you should apply. A friend of mine who's on a Cambridge City Council, Marjorie Decker, said, Jimmy, you should apply to the Kennedy School. A couple other people did.
Yeah.
Howard Zinn wrote me a letter. Tommy O'Neill wrote a letter.
You knew Zinn?
Yeah, I knew Zinn.
How'd you know Zinn?
I know Zinn from, I did a lot of shows down in Wellfleet. And his son, Jeff Zinn, ran a great theater down there called Wellfleet Harbor Actors Theater.
Uh-huh.
And it was right on the water. When I left the American Place Theater in 93, I went looking for gigs, looking for theaters, and that was one of the places I went. Howard came to the show, loved the show. He was great. We became friends of the family.
Did he inform any of your thinking?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah, yeah.
Because to have a personal relationship with a guy of that stature, you know, a singular political thinker, you know, and definitely progressive, but also someone who wrote the kind of Bible of reinterpreting history,
right?
From the victim's point of view,
right?
It must have been something to have kind of a private relationship with him.
Oh yeah, well he came to the shows, loved it. He was a big supporter of the theater.
Did he suggest things? Like, did he say? Did he help? How did he help your thinking? I mean, like, because it seems like he's a guy that would be like, put things into a different perspective.
You know, He just liked what I was doing.
Yeah.
He liked what I was doing. Yeah. He was also a friend of Barry Cremins.
Yeah.
He just supported the comedy. He supported the arts. He loved the fact that it was political. It was about something. The shows were about something. You're trying to make points. Yeah. You're making people laugh, pointing out hypocrisy, pointing out inequality, taking on bigger subjects that were difficult to talk about and that you can do in a theater.
He
was fearless.
Well, the People's History of the United States is that, it's a pretty fearless book. And I remember he taught at BU. I didn't take his class, but it was hard to get into them because it was like quite an event.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a show to be in his his lectures and stuff.
Right.
People loved it.
And he was out front on behalf of the civil rights movement in the 50s.
Yeah.
He taught at Spelman College in the South, Women's African American College, and was on the forefront of that early the civil rights movement in the late 50s. And he was just very committed. And he was fearless about the war in Vietnam.
Oh,
he was fearless about Iraq. And even when after 9/11, he was opposed to Afghanistan. He was opposed to Iraq, And so he took a lot of heat, but he never backed down. He was just very, very committed to his point of view.
Did Chomsky ever come see your shows?
Oh, yeah. I actually did a show with Howard and Chomsky.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, we did one for a fundraiser for the theater up there in Wellfleet. Yeah. And it was pretty cool because...
Well, is Chomsky a witty guy?
you know, he is.
Yeah.
He is a witty guy. He is. And it was funny because we did, I was the MC. What do we, I was MCing, and we had Howard on and then Noam. And we did it in a church in Wellfleet, Mass, the Congo church. It was about 800 people. It's packed. This is like, this is before 9/11.
Where's Wellfleet?
Wellfleet is in the Lower Cape.
Oh, okay.
The Outer Cape. It's about 10 miles north of P-Town.
Okay.
Yeah. Very cool area. And
so you're doing the show.
I'm doing the show and I'm emceeing, and it's about, but they were all about, they were all about pointing out the inequalities and what's wrong, right? And they were also about galvanizing people, but not in an effect. There was never any movement. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like an organized movement. Like, it was never a political party,
right?
You know. And I always felt like that's what we need to do. We need to be united to for social change. It's got to be some sort of a movement, not just disparate voices,
right?
And but I remember we had just passed this thing up in Massachusetts called the Clean Elections, and it was public financing in Massachusetts.
Yeah. So,
and it passed the ballot. And we got 60% of the vote, and the legislature wouldn't fund it in Massachusetts at the time. So I was so inspired by Noam and Howard talking about, you got to take action. I said, listen, we need to do a march. We need to march from Lexington and Concord to the Boston Common, and we got to march on behalf of clean elections and get the legislature to fund it. Let's do this.
Yeah.
And so everybody's, and so that was like a big... It just motivated me to get involved.
Did you do the march?
Yeah, we did it. We did it, and 9/11 happened like a month later. This was in August of 2001. 9/11 happened, you know, a month later, and we did it like 2 weeks after the 9/11. We did the march, carried the flag the whole way. It was awesome. A couple hundred people, 15-mile march. It was great, but it was those type of people that motivated me. So it wasn't just comedy. It was like, what are people? You know, people who are thinking outside the box,
right,
pushing the envelope politically, pushing the envelope
and
socially.
Progressive politics.
And exactly.
And so you applied to Kennedy Center.
I applied to the Kennedy School and got in.
Yeah.
Couldn't believe I got in. I was the only comedian ever to get in.
Yeah.
And that was a ball. That was, you know what was great about it, Mark?
3 years?
It's 1 year.
1 year.
1 year. It's a mid-career program.
Uh-huh.
And when you get out, you get a master's of public administration, but... The great thing about it was so uplifting to be around people who are committed.
Yeah.
They're from all walks of life. You had people, you had like the people who were serving in Afghanistan and Iraq, and young guys, you know, men and women over there, special forces. Uh-huh. You had corporate people. You had not people from the nonprofit world. Uh-huh. You had people who were, you know, municipal office holders around the country. You had 100 people from overseas.
Huh.
You had people from like Africa and Asia and China, Israelis and Palestinians in the same class who don't mix in Israel, but they're mixing there.
What do you learn there?
You learn about people's humanity. That's what I learned, about the positiveness and the optimism that people have. And no matter how fucked up it seems on the surface, there is a huge contingent of people moving this country and this world forward on a daily basis all over the world. And that's the, and these people there are just completely committed to that, to progress, human progress, trying to improve whatever society they come from. And it was just dynamite. We actually did comedy there. I did a thing with Israelis and Palestinians. We did a show. We got some Jewish American comedians and Palestinian Americans, and did a show. Marshall Gantz was actually the moderator of it. But anyway, it was just a very positive experience. People trying to improve the society.
Well, what kind of classes? Like, what are the nuts and bolts of it?
I had a class with David Gergen.
Oh yeah,
We had a class on organizing, political organizing.
Uh-huh.
You have classes on negotiation.
Huh.
And the classes on. Some of the classes are more general.
Yeah.
And some of them you have to take certain, you know, mathematical classes, statistics. I had to take that.
Uh-huh.
That was tough.
Yeah. Right.
That was really hard. But I loved being there. And it just, again, it's just the hope, the optimism, the feeling of that the things can change in society, and it's up to the people who are here to do the work.
And then you get out, and then so the plan is...
I actually did the commencement address
at
Harvard that year, yeah. Yeah.
I took a
class
called
Arts and Communication.
Yeah.
And people say, Jimmy, you're a comedian. You've been in the arts for 20 years or whatever. They said, why are you taking this class? I said, because I never studied it. I had no idea. I never took acting. I never took, you know.
What did you learn in that class?
They had us watching commencement addresses, how people just give a commencement address, the story, the narrative. And kind of I had been doing that with the one-man shows and comedy. But they showed us one with Steve Jobs from Stanford, his commencement address. Great, great commencement address. And I asked the professor after, I said, do they do a commencement address here at Harvard? She goes, oh, yeah. Every year, she goes, you should apply. They would love to have a funny one.
Yeah.
So I actually applied. You write
an
essay.
For the Kennedy School?
No, for the whole school.
For the whole Harvard?
The graduate school commencement address at Harvard graduation, 2010. And it was like an audition. They had like 40 people from the law school, medical school, education school, business school, Kennedy School. They write essays and they apply.
So this is the student address and then they have a celebrity?
Yeah, then they have like, Judge Souter from the Supreme Court was the main person.
Yeah,
but they have the graduate student and they have an undergraduate student. So anyway, they have 30, 40 people, then they get it down to 20, then they get it down to 10, then they get down to 5 people.
It's like
people.
The San Francisco Comedy Festival.
It was like that, man. And I'm telling you, the whole comedy career really helped when it came down to this because I was practicing the address.
I did this at the BCN Riot. I know how I can get through this.
That's exactly what I did, Mark. I was taking the commencement address and I was doing open mics with it.
No.
I was going into Passim's. Yes. I was going into Passim's. I was going into the comedy studio in Harvard Square. I was at the Cantab Lounge in Central Square.
Oh, shit.
And I was practicing.
You're running the bits?
I'm running the speech. And I'm going, listen, everybody, this is one night. It's funny. It's like 1 o'clock in the morning in the Cantab Lounge.
Yeah.
Half the audience is passed out. It's an open mic blues night, right? So it's 1 in the morning. It's a Tuesday night. And I'm like, all right, listen, Thursday morning, I'm giving the commencement address at Harvard. Right? Yeah. I just want to practice it on you guys. What do you say? People, you know, Harvard sucks. You get all these hecklers. But the people dug it. And it's just like doing a set for the Tonight Show or anything else.
Was it 15 minutes?
No, it was like, I think 8 minutes.
Oh, yeah.
8 or 9 minutes or something.
Uh-huh.
But because it was humorous, people paid attention. And you could lean on some.
Was it exciting?
Oh, it was great.
Did you meet Souter?
I did not meet, briefly. Yeah. But you know who was there? Meryl Streep was there.
Oh.
Yeah, it's on YouTube,
okay.
As a matter of fact.
Jimmy Tingle's Harvard commencement?
Jimmy Tingle's Harvard commencement address, yeah.
She was laughing?
Oh, she was digging it, yeah. She was digging it.
And so when you get out of there and you get your degree, do you sideline comedy altogether to get into politics? Or no?
I took a year off to go. I just did a couple of events that I was already booked for, but I just focused on the school. And, you know, I didn't even tell anybody I was going. I just went because I didn't want to be the first person to flunk out of the Harvard Kennedy School.
Right.
So I got out and I realized a couple of things. The cultural influence of entertainment, how important it is. We're at the Kennedy School with all these people. They're doing really important work.
Yeah.
Then most of them are never on television.
Right.
They're never on the radio.
Yeah.
They're not in the cultural conversation the way that matches the importance of what they're doing.
Mm.
So I felt if I can stick with comedy and do what I'm doing, that's a great way to try to, you know, just reach more people.
Right.
Really. And so I just went back into it and one person shows and started a little bit of an organization. It's a social enterprise called Humor for Humanity.
Uh-huh.
And that's still in the early stages, right? It's a startup, but it's a way to use entertainment for purposes beyond entertainment.
Uh-huh.
Want to hear our mission statement?
Yeah.
Humor for Humanity, more than entertainment. Raising spirits, funds, and awareness for nonprofits, charities, and social causes. Our mission is your mission. Humor for Humanity. Humor in helping, humor in healing, humor in hope. Ha, ha, ha.
So it's basically a kind of a, you set up shows for
nonprofits, progressive.
That seems like a good idea.
Yeah, it's fun.
Is it for comedy?
Yeah.
You got comedians?
Yeah, I do some
you
comedians.
You got a roster?
I have some friends that I've done some with. I just did one at the Harvard Club, actually, raised money for the Kennedy School New England Alumni Association, the board that I'm on. And, they help with the social, the nonprofits in the Boston area. But it's still in the early stages. I've been doing it primarily as a solo, just because it's simpler.
Yeah.
You know, where I perform and, you know, MC or whatever,
sure.
whatever they need.
Yeah.
And it's fun, but it's a way to actually have an impact beyond just the entertainment part. Yeah. And that's the biggest thing. And that's why I ran for office.
You ran for what, lieutenant governor?
I ran for lieutenant governor of Massachusetts. And that's what this show at the Wilbur is about on December 28th. It's called 2020 Vision.
Yeah.
And it's Jimmy Tingle's 2020 Vision is why would a comedian run for office? And it basically... I'm explaining to people why I ran. Because people, when I first ran, they go, you know, you're a comedian. You don't know anything about politics. They think you just parachuted in and just... But I said, I've been committed to a lot of these issues for many years. I have the television clips to prove it.
More than the president.
Yeah. I actually have a clip in the show from 60 Minutes where I'm doing a commentary on Donald Trump running for president in 1999.
Yeah.
And he... when he first announced that he was going to run,
yeah.
And the first time he floated the idea, yeah. 60 Minutes 2 did a segment on him.
Yeah.
And I came out of that segment doing a two-minute commentary on
him. No kidding.
A minute 40. Yeah, and I show that actually in the show at the Wilbur. So I've been committed to these things. The Tonight Show was a great experience. I was doing social and political humor at the time.
Sure.
And it was a great thing. Never wanted me back. You know, they didn't want it back at that time in 88. It was not like that. What they didn't want it.
So this is the show at the Wilbur.
Yeah.
Is primarily just about your engagement in politics and, you know, the experience of running
for office in a serious way. Yeah.
So what was it like? Did you have to put a whole campaign infrastructure together?
And, oh, yeah, I did, man.
Did you know how to do all that stuff?
I. In a way, I did. I knew what it entailed, but I got in a little late, first of all. And when you get in late to something, the staff have taken up with other campaigns.
Yeah.
So the campaign managers that, you know, would normally be available were taken up by other campaigns.
Yeah.
So that was a challenge. So I went for about, you know, 5 or 6 months without a campaign manager, trying to do it as well as I could do it. But my motivation was really coming back to that story, trying to get help in 1987. Like when the guy I called the detox and they said, you, after calling several places and getting the runaround, this guy said, you called the right place.
Right.
And I went in and it changed my life. Right. And my whole motivation was we need a society where anybody picks up a phone and reaches out for help. The answer on the other end always should be you called the right place.
Yeah. Right.
And that's the type of society we need in Massachusetts and around the country with the opioid and the drug addiction problems and the alcoholism that we have.
Yeah.
And so treating it as a medical issue, that was my primary motivation for running. That's a big issue in Massachusetts. It covers both sides of the aisle, rich, poor, black, white, doesn't matter. And it's just a huge thing, and it's a big problem up there. But anyway, so that was like my basic motivation, but also all the other issues, the public transportation, how important it is.
Yeah.
You know, when I did the Tonight Show, I was talking about guns. I was talking about homelessness.
Yeah.
I was talking about AIDS. Yeah. I was talking about all these issues that are still front and center.
Yeah.
And so I said, you know what? I just can't pay it. I just can't be a spectator anymore. I want to get involved. And when I saw Trump win, I said, you know what? If he can use his communication skills as an entertainer for his message, I can try to use my communication skills as an entertainer for our message. And people say, how did Trump win? And my estimation, short, simple sentences, short, simple messages, three words, build the wall, drain the swamp,
belligerent,
lock her up.
Anger.
Yeah.
Belligerent, shameless anger also.
Yes. Yeah.
It speaks
build
to a
the
lot
wall.
Of people.
Build, it does. Build the wall, drain the swamp, lock her up, make America great. You know, those three words. You know what? We have our own three words. Can I tell you two?
Yeah, let's
Can
go.
I tell you, Mark?
Do it up.
Feed the hungry. How's that, brother?
Nice.
How's the homeless?
Yeah.
Heal the sick.
There you go.
Welcome the stranger. And I would add, Mark, for the people in Boston, fix the T, which is our train. If John F. Kennedy could inspire a generation to go to the moon, we can get a train to go to Springfield, Massachusetts, in New York. We can get the L train to run on Sundays.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think if we put our heads together, we could get a train to connect North Station to South Station in the great city
Why
of Boston.
Not?
But that was the type of motivation.
Right.
That's what I was into.
So you feel that this show that you're doing at the Wilbur on December 28th is part of the goal to inspire people to get involved?
To take action, yes. It's part of the goal. It's to tell the story, why I did it. It was a serious campaign. I'm still going to be involved. I'm still doing whatever
I can
do.
How bad did you lose?
We got 213,000 votes. 213,000. Good news is we got 213,000 313 votes, and first time running came in second place. The bad news, two-person race. But we have 41% of the vote in the primary.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it was great, man.
You're going to run again? Great.
I might. I don't know. I don't know. If there was a unique, you know, if there was something I felt like I could, I was uniquely qualified to help with,
yeah.
I would consider it, yeah. But, and so it was a great thing, but my whole message is get involved. If you don't like what's going on, turn off the television set, call your local Democratic Party, get behind one of the candidates that are running for president, get behind people, help in the state legislature, do something, you know?
Yeah.
It's fun, it's cathartic. I helped with Hillary. The way I got involved, I was doing events for Hillary Clinton with Bonnie Frank in 2016 in October.
Yeah.
And we're doing these gigs and we're fundraisers for her, right?
Yeah.
In September and October. And it was a blast. Bonnie would do 5 minutes or 10 minutes of get out the vote, right?
Yeah.
I'd do like 10 minutes of comedy.
Yeah.
And after the last one, I said, Bonnie, you think it's too late to run for office in a serious way? He goes, no, not at all. He goes, after the election, let's have lunch. So in the next month, I do what I always do. Every election, every 4 years, I get my sign, I make phone calls, I knock on doors, I go up to New Hampshire and knock on doors and get involved and make phone calls and donate, do fundraisers, whatever. And you meet people who are like-minded. You get it out of your system. It's cathartic. So when she lost, I didn't feel as horrible as I would have if I didn't do anything.
Yeah.
You know, and there's a lot of funny stories. I'll tell you one funny story. I'm in Central Square. Central Square,
right? Sure.
I got my sign on election day. Let's do this.
Yeah.
It's election day. Let's do this.
Yeah. Right?
And people, a lot of the people ignore you. They're coming up out of the subway. They got their headphones on. They're not paying attention.
Yeah.
After a couple of hours of this, I start getting upset. Listen, people, I did not risk my life at the Battle of the Bulge so people could not vote on election day. Get involved. They're walking past me, not even listening.
Right.
Right. 2 hours later, I get even more bizarre. It's the end of the day. It's election day. People are tired. I'm delirious. I say, listen, you people. Listen, you kids. I did not take a musket ball to the knee at the Battle of Bunker Hill so young professionals in Cambridge, Massachusetts could squander their constitutional rights to vote.
Yeah.
This kid comes up to me, about 19 years old, dead serious, looks me in the eye and says, thank you for your service.
You're taking that musket ball.
I know we're all getting older, Mark, but 241.
You look great.
Thank you, brother. But that's my message. Get involved. And we got to do it statewide. And we got to do it in the swing states.
Yeah.
We got to get the ground troops, man. You know?
Yeah, I think you're right, man. I think you're right. I'm scared and I'm also excited.
Yeah.
Yeah. I guess you got, I think that's the other thing is like, you know, there was a sort of component to the other, to our side. We get discouraged and despairing and there's, you know, it's hard to, hopelessness is pervasive, you know, because we really see, you know, so many of the things that we think are important diminishing, you know, not the least of which is the planet.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's hard to have faith or to feel like anything's going to help. And I think that's a personal problem, and I think we got to transcend that.
Yeah, absolutely. You know,
we're all very sensitive.
You know, and the other thing is, let's just say people listen and they want to help Mayor Pete, or they want to help Elizabeth Warren, or they want to help Biden. Whoever you want to help, help them. But at the end of the day, we got to come together. We need the Bernie people, the Elizabeth people, the Mayor Pete people. The Democrats got to come together and unite, because if we don't, we're going to get a repeat of what happened last time.
A repeat would be, I think, you know, sadly, better than more.
Yeah.
Do you know?
Yeah, I do. I do.
Great talking to you, Jim.
Great talking to you, Mark. Thanks a million for having me, man.
Yeah, man. That was Jimmy Tingle. Jimmy Tingle's 2020 vision at the Wilbur Theater in Boston is this Saturday, December 28th. Go to jimmytingle.com for tickets and all things Jimmy Tingle related. You can go to WTFpod.com/tour for all of my tour dates. Please have a safe and happy holiday, whatever you're doing, holidays. I'll talk to you right after Christmas. So we'll talk before New Year's. So Merry Christmas. I'm a goddamn Jew. Happy Hanukkah. Here now is some music. Some ethereal distorting music for Christmas, Hanukkah, holidays, Jews, Christians, Muslims, Buddhists, Lutherans, Catholics, Baptists, Baha'i people. I don't know. Here's some music.
Boomer lives.